What's going on, everybody? On today's episode, we spoke with Ryan Blackburn, the site manager from the Denver Stiffs, which is owned by SB Nation. In our chat with Ryan, we cover how the team has handled bringing back fans to Ball Arena, Nikola Jokic's MVP case, and how he thinks the Nuggets will do in this year's playoffs. This is definitely a fun one, talking about one of the best League Pass darlings and a personal favorite of my own. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Ryan. What's going on, everybody? And welcome back to the Hoops Corner. I'm your host, Peter Tran, and on the line, the Iceman himself, Josh Cohen. How you doing?
Feeling fine. Today's a beautiful day outside. It's 22 degrees out here. I went to go shoot around this morning, so I'm feeling good.
You got shots up?
Man. I got shots up this morning.
You're a lucky guy. And joining us, our special guest for the day, Ryan Blackburn of the Denver Stiffs. Ryan, how you doing?
Good, guys. Thanks for having me on. It's a positive energy with you guys, so I'm glad to be on it this morning.
Got to bring good vibes to Denver, man. Got to keep up, keep everything going.
Oh yeah, it's been great having a good time. You guys are doing some good things up here, so let me know what I can contribute, and I'll do what I can. But thanks for having me on.
Anytime. So Ryan, as we already discussed, we talked about it earlier. Being in the pandemic, it's a little difficult for everybody. Obviously, Denver just brought back fans a couple of weeks ago, I think?
Even sooner, actually. We've had fans just for basically April. And it's been kind of crazy to see the building fill up the way that it has. But everybody is excited. Everybody is super happy to be back. And I am super happy that fans are back because it was a cavernous, empty space before that point. So I'm glad that the energy is just back in this building.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you feel is it different for everybody? Like, I mean, even going down to like people work the concessions, like the announcers, the people working the tables, everyone just got like this different energy. I'm sure like a 7-game winning streak kind of helps as well.
Oh sure. It's everybody's glowing. Like it really does feel palpably different. And you have more people involved than there were in the past. And I remember because I went to a Detroit game back in January or February that was canceled. It was the one earlier in the season that was canceled due to COVID health and safety protocols. And I didn't go back to this one, but I had one of my guys, Brandon Ewing, on staff. He went back. And the difference between the first Detroit game and the second Detroit game, with a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of energy, just the team in a positive place. Everybody is very excited. Everybody's in a great spot right now. So you never want to put the cart before the horse, but there's a vibe right now at Ball Arena that you didn't usually get even in seasons past. So I'm really happy with it.
What are the safety protocols for the media coming in and also the fans coming into the arena? And where do you actually sit now as a media member?
So,
what's changed, really?
Yeah, so I sit basically in the same place that I did. But what they did at the beginning of the season that they've continued up through now is they have two separate zones. The red zone is the zone where the players are, where important personnel resides, everybody that basically goes onto floor level, everybody that's involved with the production and the safety of the players and security and things like that. Everybody there, they get tested all the time. They are separated from the group of media and other personnel that resides in the yellow zone. And the yellow zone basically doesn't interact with the red zone at all. We were kind of separated, not like sequestered or anything like that, but we basically don't interact with the players, the coaches, anybody like that whatsoever, other than just long conversations from different levels of the concourses. This team and kind of the way that this organization has really framed it, they've put the red zone people on floor level. And anybody else that goes from the yellow zone, they're one concourse up. That's usually where I sit. That's usually where other media members sit. And it's worked out well. We haven't had any issues from a COVID health and safety protocol standpoint. But as fans have come back in, they've basically done a lot of the yellow zone's requirements. They, with the kind of social distancing aspects with everything you get involved with there. You show a survey that you take on your phone that says that you haven't had COVID. You wear a mask all the time, and you make sure that you're not interacting with people. You're not getting close to anybody. And at that point, you're usually fine. And it's been good. It feels a lot more normal than it did at the beginning, where it really was just me and like 14 other people that were coming to this game. Now we've got 4,000 people. And yes, it's a little bit weird. You have to navigate through a bunch of people that you didn't used to. But that's just kind of how life is. And that's how kind of getting back into the swing of things. You just got to start somewhere. So I'm glad that they're starting here.
Is there still COVID testing for fans and media members before the game, or is there COVID sniffing dogs like in Miami?
No, they aren't doing COVID testing. I think it really is on the honor system that as long as you have taken the survey that says, hey, I have been monitoring myself. I don't have a temperature. I don't have any COVID signs. I can attest that my temperature was this amount or below, and I haven't been in contact with anybody with COVID within the last 14 days, to my knowledge. Then they usually there's no issues there at that point. And because they're in the yellow zone and completely sequestered anyway, away from the people that like the players and the floor personnel, then there aren't any problems with that. But it's to this point, there haven't been any issues. And I at least none to my knowledge with people at Ball Arena. That might not be true going forward. They may have more issues now that fans are back in the building, but I haven't seen anything or heard of anything just yet.
Is it weird for you to call it Ball Arena?
Oh yeah. No, we've been trying to come up with great nicknames for Ball Arena. Like, because the canned was Pepsi Center. Yeah. It was always Pepsi Center. It's been Pepsi Center for 20 years. Yeah. What are you going to call Ball Arena? Is it ballerina? Like a dancer? Is it the sack? Is it like, where are we going with here? Like, this is it's a weird concept that it can change on a dime like that, because it really always will be Pepsi Center. It's I've had to train myself in order to start calling it Ball Arena, because that's what they would prefer me to call it. But it is what it is. Like, you just want to kind of got to keep moving forward with it.
Yeah, we had the same situation in Toronto too with Air Canada Center.
Sure.
And now it's known as, I'm not even sure what it's called anymore.
Scotiabank Arena.
Yeah, Scotia. Yeah, Scotia. Yeah.
Whenever I talk to anyone in the organization, they're like, yeah, I'm going to SBA later. I'm like, what? You mean ACC, what? Right? Like, that's not a place. What are you talking about?
It'll always be known as Air Canada Center, right? It's the house that VC built. Like, come on now.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's get into it. We all saw how far the Nuggets got last year in the bubble. Western Conference Finals. Some amazing performances by Jokic and Murray. Where did you feel that this team would end up this year? Or like, what kind of expectations did you have? Did you feel like the team had around like the organization, since I think you're more plugged in than a lot of other people are out there, right?
Yeah, I it's interesting because I thought that they would take a step back, or at least a minor step back, without Jerami Grant. He was a guy that I had circled as, okay, this is a very, very important piece for their future. And he up and left. And that was a really big problem for this team at the beginning of the year, where they didn't have his athleticism, his versatility, his ability to kind of mold and shift his game into different scenarios. Like, that was a really important piece of what this team needed and what they needed in the bubble. And he really showed that throughout his bubble run. I knew that at the beginning. Like, that was something that was very important. He was able to start at the three next to Paul Millsap, which should never have been a thing. But he was also going to be a guy who started at the four next to Michael Porter Jr. and sort of unlocked what Denver was able to do. Without him on the floor, I thought, okay, this is probably going to be an issue, because they couldn't really replace him at that point. And I had circled Aaron Gordon as an option for them to try to target, to see, okay, hey, this is a guy that could really sort of fill that void. He could fill that role that they had. And it bore out. It came to fruition. And it was a long kind of roundabout way that they were able to do it. But they ultimately got it done. And this team has figured things out in the meantime. And now they look like a juggernaut. Now they look like a really, really impressive team that I don't know how many holes they actually have in their roster anymore.
So one of the main reasons, maybe the main reason as to why they're so impressive is the performance of Nikola Jokic, obviously.
Sure.
So this year he's been super consistent throughout the entire season. Like, he's my MVP right now, absolutely right now. I mean, him and Embiid were going head-to-head for a while before Embiid got injured. But I think right now, like, you see that every game he's putting up pretty much the exact same numbers. Like, he's been super consistent, putting up, you know, near triple-double numbers every single game. So besides conditioning, which we all know about, he came into this year in the best condition he's ever been in. What other things do you attribute his success and his consistency overall to?
I think his mentality change had to shift at the beginning of the year when Denver lost their... They lost their flexibility with Jeremy Grant. Paul Millsap was a little bit older and clearly couldn't give them as much of the one-on-one post scoring that they had before. Michael Porter wasn't ready. Then he went out due to COVID anyway. Jamal Murray started slow. Gary Harris, like, he started the season shooting like 8% from three. Like, and that was that's something that people forgot. Right. Like, that was a thing that happened. Nikola Jokic had to carry the team. Just absolutely put them on his back in order to just survive. And people don't give him enough credit for that nationally. They had nothing. They had nothing going for them. And that was what really stood out with Jokic, was he was averaging a 28-point triple-double or something close to that at the beginning of the season. And the team was only getting to 500 because they couldn't get any higher. Their bench was a mess. The starting unit was a mess. And Michael Porter was out. And there's just so many factors working against this team at the beginning of the year. They're still trying to figure out, like, they were going to go into the season starting Jeremy Grant to power forward. And they had no idea that they were going to bring back Paul Millsap. They're working back in Jermichael Green. They had working in Isaiah Hartenstein. Like, there's just working in Facu Campazzo. Like there were a lot of pieces that they had to figure out on the fly that weren't working out for them at the outset. So this was a really, really important part, I think, of Jokic's MVP dominance. He had to be the MVP in order to get this team to 500, and they did. And then as the rest of it sort of sorted out, Jamal Murray got back rolling, Michael Porter got rolling, then you could start to see the makings of a championship team, and Jokic was still doing his thing at that point. So that's the scoring aspect, the overall takeover mentality aspect of it. That is what I would point to as what has really separated Jokic. It's not something that he had before. He would show it in the playoffs. He would show it pretty consistently when the going got tough, but the going got tough from game one. And that's something that had never happened with this team before. And he really showed that he could do it.
Yeah. I think the most consistent guys at the beginning of the year were basically Jokic and like Monte Morris.
Yeah. Yeah. Monte was big. And then like, it's really crazy because over the last 10 games, he had been out. Everybody has had that stretch where they were inconsistent, and it has only been Jokic. Jokic is the only guy on this roster now that you can point to and say, yeah, he showed up every game. He showed up every time. And that is something that people don't necessarily take into account, that when you're talking about MVP candidates, having somebody that shows up every single night, not 33 games, all 100% of the games. That is something that Jokic will do every single time. And he's taken it to a new level this year.
He didn't tank out his team. He didn't show up late to training camp or at the start of the season.
That is true.
Just being there.
That is something that happened in Houston. Yeah.
I think the other reason too is, you know, obviously in Serbia, there's a lot of Serbian fans that are waking up at what, 3-4 in the morning to watch his games. And he said that, you know, he plays every game because he wants to make sure that the people that are staying up get to see him every night, right?
It's a great thought. And it's something that really goes overlooked, that his connection with his Serbian roots has really driven him to this point. He got married over the offseason. He got into shape, just has been in a better position as a more mature player, where he's taking a more mature look at how he can impact the game, how he impacts so many people. And he didn't want any part of that at the beginning of his career. He just wanted to play basketball. He just wanted to kind of do his thing and be the joker. And that has really changed. Like, he's really matured. He still has his humorous side. Don't get me wrong. He's the guy who takes himself the least seriously in the NBA from everything you hear. But he is taking himself seriously in that one aspect where he matters to a lot of people, and he doesn't take that for granted anymore. And that has really stood out in his approach. It's really stood out in just the way that he comports himself. And I like that about him a lot.
Over the past like couple of weeks, we've seen basically him and Mike Malone, you know, complaining to the refs a lot more. That I think Jokic averages like 4 free throws a game or something absurd, or 5 at most. I think it's 4.7. He's hitting 4 of them. So, you know, obviously incredible numbers. But do you think these complaints are actually going to go anywhere, or, you know, do the refs finally listen and, you know, see all the marks on the guy's arms and his body throughout the game?
We'll see. You see these pictures surface where his arm is just like red as a sunburn from being hit and bashed. And it's just kind of nuts the way that things have gone. I thought that he would have a little bit more respect by now. I thought that he would be able to draw those fouls, especially when he's seeking them out, because he's a guy that he gets a lot of non-shooting fouls. And that is a good thing. That helps put the opposing team in the bonus. But when it comes down to it, and when he's trying to get to the line himself, he struggles getting there because for whatever reason, when he goes up for a shot, it just, I don't know what the referees are seeing at this point, where he's getting hit on the wrist, he's getting hit on the hand, he's getting hit on the arm, he's getting hit in the face, and it just sort of goes by the wayside. And I don't know what they're going to do. They are mad. With the Nuggets organization is very upset right now. I think Michael Malone getting thrown out of a game is a great kind of crescendo there. But this has been brewing for a long time. And the Nuggets have been very unhappy with how Nikola Jokic has been officiated. They've sent in clips. They've sent in stats to the league. And that just hasn't really changed anything to this point.
Maybe the solution now is to go the Luka Doncic approach and just complain after literally every single play, even on like a fast break layup where he's all alone, you know, complaining after that type of play as well. Because, you know, Jokic, he didn't really complain a lot throughout the start of the year, I would say, but it's definitely picked up over the last couple. You can see him getting, you know, very aggravated, obviously.
He's frustrated, and to his credit, like he probably has a right to be. I don't usually like to be the one to complain about the refs, but I've found myself complaining about the refs more often than not of late, because the discrepancy just feels very odd. It feels like the Nuggets have to go above and beyond and really show, hey, this is a foul. This is definitely a foul. You must call this call like right here. And it takes about 3 or 4 tries before they ultimately get said call. It is going to be a fascinating thing to watch as the postseason nears, because that's something that postseasons are really that really impacts what a playoffs will look like. That if Nikola Jokic can get calls, then that changes Denver's calculus. If he can't get calls, then you might see him more as a perimeter big as opposed to a post-up big in a lot of situations. And I'm not sure that the Nuggets want the flexibility to be able to do both. So we're gonna have to see how it goes. But I think that they, like, look, if Jokic is the clear MVP at the end of the season, then he might get more calls in a playoff series. If he's not, and things take a weird turn, then things are going to get weird. That I know.
So, you know, we started talking about Jokic obviously starting the year strong, and then sort of everyone else is like working their way into it. Do you know what happened to Jamal Murray after the bubble? Like, was he just mentally worn out? Was he physically worn out? Because, you know, everyone expected Jamal Murray to take that next leap after his incredible performance. You know, people were talking about him being a potential all-star this year, and then he came out of the gates just like turtling his way out, basically.
Yeah, he's talked about this in the past to me, to others, that it was just a very exhausting performance in the bubble. And he had a lot put on his shoulders from both a playing standpoint to a racial equality standpoint. He carried a heavy burden for himself, for his teammates, and for the NBA. And when he got out of the bubble, it was a very big relief. He barely touched a basketball after that point, at least in a serious capacity. And he just tried to recover as much as possible. He did the same thing at the All-Star break this year, and then kind of struggled out of the gate there as well on the end of those couple of games coming out of the All-Star break. So I have a theory, and it's not my own theory. Like I've kind of posited this with a few other people that he is a guy that he needs to be engaged and locked in, and he does a really bad job of kind of torquing up when it comes to rest. Like he can't just go from resting to then playing and be as effective as he usually is. He needs to be on the grind. He needs to be a player that's locked in all the time. And it can be exhausting to do that. And so the Nuggets will take a couple of games where he kind of has a slow time getting up to speed. But at the beginning of this year, it was a difficult prospect to try to get him up to speed because they needed it. And they didn't have that much room for error. And as we're talking about with Jokic, like nothing else was going well. And Jokic was playing at an MVP level and they could barely scrape 500. So it is a thing that I know Jamal wants to like. I tend to think that that injury at the beginning of the year that he suffered against Houston, where he got run into by one of the Houston players and it kind of cracked him to the floor a little bit. I think he hurt his right elbow, his shooting elbow. Had he not had that, I think Denver would be in a better position and he probably would have made an All-Star team. He was coming on towards the end of the All-Star voting cycle, and I think he was very close to really making a serious push. Had he been doing that for most of the year as opposed to like 15, 20 games in is when he really got started. I think things change.
Is his current knee injury a cause for concern or is it just general maintenance right now?
It really is maintenance. Michael Malone sounded very unconcerned about where his knee injury was at. It sort of cropped up and he's a guy that he needs to take care of his body. And I think he's finally starting to really appreciate that. Hey, I could take a day off here or there. I could really take a couple days to rest up my body and make sure that I am ready for the playoffs because he doesn't have to go push for an All-Star game right now. Like he just has to make sure that he is ready for the postseason and he's going to do that. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're recording this on a Friday. Like I wouldn't be surprised if he is back for this game tonight against San Antonio. That's kind of where I'm at with him. If he takes the game off, then I wouldn't be surprised either. Because look, Denver's in a situation where they have enough guys that they can win these games without him. They weren't in that situation in February and March. They needed every single game that they could get. Now in April, now that they have Aaron Gordon and a really good Michael Porter Jr., they are okay.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, at this point, the main concern has to be looking towards the playoffs, right? And just making sure everyone is healthy enough to keep going and then sort of figuring out the rotations before then, right? So I could see him sitting out like another couple of games, you know, sort of resting up as much as he can and then sort of getting into the swing of things just before the playoffs hit because inevitably that's what it's all about.
Of course. Yeah, he's gonna take that in. He's going to account for that for sure. This team does still need to build up some chemistry, like with Aaron Gordon, with Michael Porter. You've got a lot of guys that are very unique that need to be in a good position to succeed and learning how to succeed in those different situations. So I tend to think that he'll be back sooner rather than later. But if he does take a couple games off here or there to rest up his knee, or maybe that's like it could be the elbow, it could be the wrist, it could be literally anything that he's dealing with. That hey, it says knee right now, but it really is just general maintenance is what I would describe it as.
So getting into the rotational aspect of things, what rotation do you ultimately see Malone playing in the playoffs? Like which guys would you trust off the bench? Because Denver has a lot of guys off the bench. But which guys do you think will ultimately be playing 15, 25 minutes off the bench that Malone will trust when they play the better teams come round, hopefully 2 and 3?
15 to 25 minutes is a good qualifier because I think it's a caveat that, look, they could play Paul Millsap or JaVale McGee, but those guys are going to play 10, maybe 15 minutes on a good day. So like, I'm with you there that it's really about the important pieces off the bench. You have to start with Monte Morris. He's the guy who this Nuggets team, they revolve around with that bench unit. He is a very versatile piece. He's a piece that Michael Malone trusts. He's proven himself over and over again in the regular season and the playoffs as a guy that they can trust. So I've liked what I've seen from him. I think you put Jamichael Green into that place as well. He has a little bit more mobility, a little bit more strength, can do a lot more, not a lot more, but kind of the same things that Paul Millsap does defensively, while also being a slightly more reliable offensive player at this point. I like what I've seen from Jamichael Green. And then I put PJ Dozier in that category as well. Sort of a bigger guard, smaller wing type that you need in the playoffs in order to play a versatile brand of basketball. PJ Dozier was struggling with his shot for a while. He did make one in this last game. We'll see if he can continue that. But I tend to think that the ceiling of the Nuggets, it involves a PJ Dozier time on the court where he can be a versatile wing defender that can slash to the rim on offense. And it would be those three guys along with the starters, 8-man rotation that extends to 9 if you're including a guy like JaVale McGee. Sometimes you might play Facu Campazzo a little bit of minutes, but those are going to be minor moves. It's mostly going to be Jokic playing 40 minutes, Murray playing 40 minutes, and then trying to figure it out from there.
Yeah, I think Dozier might end up taking over Gary Harris's role from the past couple of years, right? As like the main perimeter defender. Obviously, he's going to come off the bench, so he'll have to bring that energy too. But I wouldn't really be trusting Will Barton as like the primary defender on the perimeter against guys like, you know, Donovan Mitchell or Paul George kind of types.
Well, it's tough because you want Denver's offense to be at the absolute apex of what they can be. And I think Will Barton does contribute to that. There are certain factors with Barton that I'm a little bit concerned about. Like you said, hey, defense is not going to be his strong suit, but he has improved. He has shown like at least strides on that end when it comes to defending guys at the 2 versus defending guys at the 3. That's what Aaron Gordon is for. That's what Michael Porter is for. Will Barton, his job just got a lot easier in terms of defending 2s. Could Denver need a better solution there? Yes. That's why PJ Dozier is going to be involved. That's why Jamal Murray taking the step forward defensively that he has, that is important as well. I like what I've seen from PJ Dozier, though. I think he is a guy that Michael Malone trusts. He will put him into those situations. And if not, it's going to be Monte Morris, and they have another point guard on the floor, and their offense is going to kill anyway. So it should be fine.
So what are the one or two factors that you worry about the most with regards to this new lineup and this Denver team when, you know, they play the better teams in the Western Conference? Like, they might get up to the 2 seed potentially, but, you know, when they get there, like, round 2, for example, they play the Clippers. Like, what's the one or two things you're most worried about?
You know what's funny is that I don't necessarily worry about the Clippers matchup anymore. Like, I think that... Denver is in a situation where they have Nikola Jokic. They have the best player in that series, a series that involves Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. And it really just changes the calculus of everything. That despite the fact that Ivica Zubac is a good defender, he'll do a good job on Denver and on Jokic. He's still not the caliber of defender. Like, nobody really is the caliber of defender that you need in order to stop a guy like Jokic. They're like, if you show Rudy Gobert is a guy that, like, they wanted to do what they could to play him one-on-one against Jokic, and Jokic still torched him in a lot of those situations. So I think that the Clippers matchup, if I were to circle one thing, it's that Serge Ibaka, if they go 5 out, if they start spacing the floor with 5 guys that can shoot the 3 really well, that is a concern. If Michael Porter isn't hitting the shots that he needs to hit, that is a concern. But other than that, like, Denver, they've showed their formula. They know that they can beat the Clippers now, and I feel pretty confident about a matchup like that. The one that I still circle is the Lakers. Like, that's a tough ask. And when you talk about what the Lakers are going to do, they're going to put LeBron at the 3, which means that Aaron Gordon's guarding him, and they're going to put Anthony Davis at the 4, which means, is that Michael Porter's responsibility? Are they going to switch it up and put Jokic on him, which doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense because then Porter's guarding like a guy like Andre Drummond. It's not a cut and dry case. There's a lot of mismatches on the court there. And it does force a guy like Anthony Davis to guard Michael Porter Jr. And that is something that I think the Nuggets fans would be pretty happy with, because then he's not guarding Jokic. He's not guarding Paul Millsap and helping off on him like kind of a center fielder. But there are a lot of reasons to be excited about this starting group. I don't have that many concerns. Most of them are very minor. Will Barton's defense, as you guys pointed out, is one of them. But other than that, like this starting lineup just doesn't have that many holes right now.
Maybe we'll get to see an extra large Denver Nuggets lineup again. Like Aaron Gordon, yeah. Nikola Jokic, and JaVale McGee against this Lakers team. Porter at the two. Cool. Put a Dozier at the one just to make it extra tall.
It'll be fun. It'll be cool. Like I don't think the Nuggets have ever had the personnel to really be able to do something like that. The closest thing you could say is Bol Bol instead of JaVale McGee. But like they could do a lot of crazy things. And like, I still think that Aaron Gordon, like you want him on LeBron because he's strong and he's quick. I looked at what a guy like JaMychal Green did against LeBron in the first matchup that they had. And it was kind of ugly. Like there's just like the more size that you put like that on the floor, it's just going to cramp up the offensive end and it's playing into the hands of the Lakers where they are going to be able to get out and run. JaMychal Green can't stop LeBron James in transition. So that they're going to figure it out from an offensive perspective, but you're just making it easier for them on the defensive end if you go too big. JaVale McGee might be different because he could play that dunker spot or kind of the short role while Jokic plays up top. There are some ways that they could do that, but I wouldn't overplay it because it could get a little weird.
When they do play the Lakers, for example, like the Lakers are a very smart defensive team, obviously. So do you worry about Gordon and Barton shooting on the perimeter as the playoffs progress and they do play against a team like the Lakers?
I don't worry about Barton. He has had his playoffs misgivings in the series a couple of years ago against San Antonio. He was very injured at that point, and he's just a different player than he was. I trust him to be able to do those things. Aaron Gordon is a different one because we've never seen him play in a Nuggets uniform in a playoff series. I just don't know what to expect. But one thing that I know is going to be impactful is his ability to just play on the interior and continue to float. He'll make great cuts. He'll offensive rebound. He'll do everything that he can as a playmaker. It's just a different level than if somebody like Paul Millsap were to struggle on the perimeter, because if Paul Millsap isn't shooting threes, what is he doing against a guy like LeBron James or Anthony Davis on the inside? That's a big question. If you have Aaron Gordon, he's getting offensive rebounds a little bit more. He's cutting to the rim, being a very versatile weapon, is still a better playmaker than any other guy outside of Jokic that the Nuggets have in their front court. So I tend to think that it'll be okay, even if he's not shooting. But it's going to be tested, and teams are going to try to maximize Denver's weaknesses if they can. That could be one of their weaknesses that shows up. Aaron Gordon, he has to shoot above 35% from three. If he can't do that, then that's a big question mark, and it sort of tilts a series one direction or the other. We'll just have to see which way that goes.
Do you think that Porter Jr.'s defense is here to stay? Because, I mean, obviously he's been really hot shooting the ball over the past couple of weeks, right? Especially since Aaron Gordon came around, and obviously it's loosened him up a bit. But, I mean, his defense has gotten better, right? Like, he's making better rotations. Yeah. He's actually staying in front of his player or his opposition. Like, he's actually clicked in. Something nice to see.
There are reasons to be concerned. He hasn't been tested by an elite offense in a while. And the Clippers are an elite offense, but I don't know, like he kind of stood up to that challenge too, right? Like switching onto a guy like Paul George, switching onto a guy like Kawhi, and you felt pretty good about him in those situations in a way that you didn't necessarily feel great beforehand. I tend to think about it, a team like Utah or a team like Phoenix, teams that have elite guards. And when they get Porter on switches, how they're going to attack him? Are they just going to put him in different actions? Are they going to just go at him in isolation? I think he's really improved as an isolation defender, but against elite guards, I don't know how much that's going to matter. Because he's still a 6'10 guy, and those guards are usually pretty good at just getting space even against 6'10 guys. So I wonder if that's going to be a big question mark. But other than that, I don't have a lot of questions about him anymore. The only thing that I could say, foul trouble against a guy like Anthony Davis would be a really big question. And there are going to be other matchups, too, where that really takes precedence. If he has to guard a guy like Bojan Bogdanović for Utah, like, or Joe Ingles from Utah, can he avoid fouling those guys when they drive into him and try to draw fouls? That is a big question mark for him, because he's shown a propensity to kind of rack up fouls in quick bunches. We'll see if he can avoid that, because he matters too much on offense. Like, that can't happen.
Have the Nuggets gotten to a point where they're actually going to rely on Michael Porter Jr. offensively in the playoffs? Or are they just going to revert back to running pick and roll pretty much every play that matters with Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic? I mean, like, Porter has taken his game to another level recently, obviously. So if this continues come playoff time, will they actually run plays for him and, you know, do that in big moments?
Run plays is different than just trying to incorporate him. Because I think that they're just going to try to run offense. They're going to try to run their sets where they free up different actions and they free up different spaces on the floor. And whoever's in that space, they're going to take advantage. The Nuggets are doing a really good job right now with their starting lineup of switching up their roles. They're switching up where guys are going to play. And they do a really nice job of incorporating a lot of different players into a lot of different shots. Porter is a guy that can take advantage of all of those on the floor. And so if he happens to be in that situation and they get him a couple of buckets early, maybe he's a guy that they go to pretty consistently in a playoff game and they try to have him win said playoff game for them with his outside shooting, with his inside shooting. They can do that. When the going gets tough, this team's always going to revert back to Murray Jokic two-man game. That's just who they are. And it's worked out. Like I can't think of a situation where I wouldn't want that. Just kind of closing out games because they've gotten so good at what they do that in a close game, you don't necessarily want to change too much of it up. You in the first 45 minutes of the game, you're okay with going to different guys. You're okay with trying to incorporate different pieces in there and making sure that everybody eats. But when the winning time happens, that's when Jamal Murray shows up. That's when Nikola Jokic shows up in the biggest possible way. And I like what Denver does with that regard. They've really developed that over the course of five long years of making sure that everything works. Porter will get his touches though at the beginning. And I don't think like he's still a guy that they're going to want to count on because he has clearly shown and clearly earned that he deserves those looks. He's on par and past a guy like Will Barton now who like he's just going to make a lot of shots. Like Porter has shown the propensity to do that. He even showed it in the playoffs last year, and he was a rookie then. So imagine what he does in year two. I'm trying to contain my excitement for Michael Porter Jr. at this point.
So now I have the most important question of this podcast so far. Why can't Will Barton make a layup?
It's crazy, isn't it? It's I don't understand it. I think that there are a lot of questions with regard to Will's athleticism, whether it's concentration, whether it's just not getting up as high as he thinks he is. But he has been one of the worst guys in the NBA at lay-ins, at just laying the ball up on the rim and having a drop. And there's a lot of small guards that he compares to in that regard. There's a lot of rookies that he's comparing to in that regard. It's a bad situation. That's Denver's biggest offensive weakness right now with that starting group is like Will Barton on the slightly contested layups. We'll see if that changes in the playoffs and whether he can finish those on a more consistent basis. I tend to think that he's a guy that when he locks in, he'll be okay. Because like he does that in the fourth quarter too, where he will lock in the fourth quarter. He'll make some clutch threes. He'll make a clutch free throws here or there. It's about focus. It's about the ironclad like ability to just block out everything else. He's a guy that I respect a lot for his mental focus and his ability there. So I think he'll be okay, but it is something to be said of that. Like he has really struggled in that regard this year.
So you don't think it's got to like Nick Anderson levels yet?
Not quite yet. Not quite at that threshold, but we'll see. We'll see. I'm waiting. I want to see it in the playoffs for sure.
Because last game that I watched, he had a play where he cut to the basket. Jokic found him. There was nobody around him, and he traveled. It was incredible.
he's quite a character. But I like Will. He's a guy that's earned the benefit of the doubt for sure. We'll see if he can right the ship. But like, he's got 20 games, and then he's got the playoffs, and it's going to be important because Denver can win it this year, and it could be those plays that swing the series for them.
All right, we got some rapid fire questions for you. So, you know, first thing that comes to your mind kind of answers. Who's your all time top five starting five Nuggets team?
Okay. Fat Lever at point guard. Nice. David Thompson as shooting guard. We'll go Melo at small forward. We'll go LaPhonso Ellis at power forward and Jokic at center. Ooh. No, we'll stick with it. LaPhonso Ellis, you want that all big right. athletic dude to play next to Jokic and do all the things that a guy like Aaron Gordon does right now, but even better. Like, LaPhonso Ellis was a dude built. That would be great.
And any sixth man considerations?
Jamal Murray. We'll put Jamal Murray at sixth man. Like, he's a guy that has really earned that over the course of these past few years.
So, yeah. As of right now, who would you rather start a franchise with, Porter Jr. or Jamal Murray?
Oh, man. It's the tantalizing potential of Michael Porter Jr. as a shot maker is undeniable. I think that if you're going for steady, if you're going for somebody that is definitely going to lead you to a playoffs down the line, I think Jamal Murray is on track to be a guy like Damian Lillard. He may not get there. Like, we'll see. We'll see if he can reach that level, but he has shown a lot to me in the last 12 months, basically, with the way that he comported himself throughout the bubble experience, and then how he continued to build up his game over the course of the past couple of years, the past couple months even, and he's just a guy that I trust. Like, I think he's going to be great, and it's not just Jokic. Like, he does it in his own way. And he's grown his game because of Jokic, but if he were to have his own team, he would lead teams to the play. He would lead guys to the playoffs. That's my opinion.
Did you ever play ball growing up, like in school or anything, and that kind of stuff?
I played briefly. I didn't play for a long time. Here's the story. I was a really, really good football and baseball player, and I wanted to try basketball a little bit. I had a lot of fun with it starting in high school. And the very first practice that I attended, I broke my finger catching a basketball. And I just decided at that point, okay, so I could either try this and I could either try to continue to grow my game and try to go three sports, or I could just focus on the two. Yeah. And I decided to just focus on the two. So I focused on baseball. I focused on football. Played pretty well. I tore my labrum in my shoulder pitching, and that was kind of it for me for baseball at that point in my junior year. But football, I'll always have football. I was pretty good at football.
Who's the best interview you've ever had?
Nothing really comes out. Like, nothing really comes to mind here. I will say Michael Malone. It's sort of boring that Michael Malone is the guy that I'm going to say here, but he is great with the media. He is just really, really good. And he gives a lot of great answers. He pokes fun at the media all the time, pokes fun at me. And he's a guy that when you get into his corner and when he knows that you're not trying to like go after him with things, like, he will give you great answers and he will laugh it up and he holds court in the media room. And so that's a pretty cool thing. If it were a player, I would say that Paul Millsap's a guy that you could just talk to and he gives you great answers all the time. Like, he's such a professional. He knows you're not trying to go after him. Like, he wants to like help you out, which is cool.
Have you guys ever seen Paul Millsap's TikTok account?
Oh, yeah. He's the magic man.
he's really leaned into this magic and just being that cool uncle vibe. I like it. Like, clearly identifying himself as the elder statesman of the team.
Oh, it's great. He has there was one Instagram post I think he had where he was basically sharing a quote that didn't mean, like, it didn't involve the Nuggets in any way, shape, or form. He's just like, he posted a picture of himself, shared this Nuggets quote, and said, "That didn't have anything to do with the game, but I thought it was cool. Good win, guys." It's just so funny. He's just a character.
That's good. Were you weren't around for the Andre Miller years, were you?
No, that was before me. I was in college, or like high school college at around that point, and tried to just get into this business at that point. But Andre Miller, he's another guy kind of like Paul Millsap, that just a very great vet.
There were stories about Andre Miller just like chilling in the media room before the games, just eating the media dinners, just because like the team dinners weren't good enough for him.
if you could do that and then go out there and play the way that Andre Miller played, which, to be frank, like, not the most athletic dude, not the most like that is YMCA at its finest right there. He is a guy that it just stands out. I gain a larger appreciation for Andre Miller's game the longer out that I am, because the way that he plays, it kind of stands the test of time in a way that I didn't appreciate in the moment.
So who would be on your Mount Rushmore of players right now?
Of player, like all NBA
all time,
in general?
All time.
Oh, well, Jokic has got it. I'm just kidding.
He might get there one day.
You can say it.
He might get there one day. Let's go with a guy named Michael Jordan. Let's go with LeBron. Let's go with Kareem, although I can understand why people are a little bit hesitant on him, or they might be go the other way and say that they shouldn't be hesitant on him. The fourth one is really interesting. I'll say Magic Johnson. Like, I think that he changed the game in a very tangible way, and kind of bringing forth a new era of basketball, a modern era of basketball with him. And he's sort of the archetype that you're looking for in today's NBA, with big wings that can handle and pass and do everything that he can do. Nobody could do it like Magic, really, but he was a guy that sort of changed the landscape of the league.
That's pretty good. All right, the last question. In light of the news today, I'm pretty sure you would have seen it before we started recording as well. DMX passed away, 50 years old. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite DMX song? Just end it with that.
Let's see. I have to. I've got to get this right, because
it's a lot of pressure here.
Yeah, this is tough. I think Where the Hood At is probably the one that I would like. That one speaks to, like, that's like, I'm a complete, like, white pasty fool. where the Hood At really speaks to me a little bit, because he was just such a badass and just completely comported himself in that way, where you loved to hear him sing, you loved to hear him just go hard on the mic, and he did it in a different way than other people, and that really stands out. We talk about a guy like DMX who just his music is going to stand for a while. Like people don't really appreciate it in the moment right now, but it is going to stand forever. And he's a guy that really, his music is going to be big for a long time. So big up DMX. He's a guy who really stands out as one of the best rappers of all time.
Yeah. Mine is Rough Riders Anthem, because I remember that movie Down to Earth with Chris Rock.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That was the very first time I heard that song. And I was like, this is just perfect on so many levels.
Gotta love it. DMX is an icon, man. He's great.
Yeah, I probably have to go with Rough Riders Anthem too. And It's Dark and Hell is How is the first CD that I ever bought. So I love DMX.
All right, well, Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us, man. I mean, personally, I've been waiting for this for a long time. I haven't gotten to talk about the Nuggets for, like, almost an hour in a long time, because I'm a big homer. Joined the Nuggets bandwagon in, like, 08, 09 when Chauncey was traded there, and been there ever since. So this is a real pleasure, man. Thanks a lot.
Of course, man. I'm happy to do it. And let me know if you guys have, if you ever need a Nuggets guest during the playoffs, then just let me know.
Oh, hell yeah. I'll be asking you about the parade route.
Let's go. We'll go right by the Bronco Stadium, where they basically paraded everywhere. Everybody talks about the Broncos in Denver, and we got to start talking about the Nuggets a little bit more, because this team is legit. They are just absolutely great. So
see you at the sack, or whatever you're calling it.
Let's go. I'm excited.